If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
I think a really great success story for the project is that the number of skilled plasterers in the state almost doubled over the course of this apprenticeship program and the project. And I think that really bodes well for preservation moving forward, because if these trades are allowed to, these artisans are allowed to disappear, you know, the skills are allowed to disappear, then we're really in a bad spot when it comes to preserving this architectural heritage that we have.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Andrew Smith, AIA, APT, RP, Principal and Historical Architect at Henneberry Eddy Architects, right here in my hometown of Portland, Oregon. Andrew is an historical architect and seasoned project manager with more than 30 years of experience in the planning, design execution, and administration of both new construction and rehabilitation projects. His expertise includes directing project teams in finding sensitive and appropriate design solutions when historic and cultural resources are involved, including several projects for the National Park Service. At Henneberry Eddy, Andrew is a principal and leader in the firm's Historic Resources Group, serving federal, state, and private clients in the thoughtful assessment, rehabilitation, and stewardship planning of historic structures. The project we are talking about today is the Oregon Supreme Court Interior Modernization and Seismic Retrofit in Salem, Oregon. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. The rehabilitation of the Oregon Supreme Court building repositions a Beaux-Arts landmark as an adaptive architectural system, capable of absorbing contemporary performance demands while maintaining its spatial and material integrity. Situated on the Capitol Mall in Salem, the 1914 structure is the oldest government building in the ensemble, a composition of symmetry, proportion, and classical order designed by state architect William Christmas Knighton.
Well, it was built in 1914, and it is actually the oldest building on the Capitol Mall in Salem, which I don't think a lot of people realize, since it's barely over a 100-year-old building, but it is the oldest one. It was designed by William Christmas Knighton, and he was actually the first and only state architect of the state of Oregon, and from 1911 to 1915. So he didn't do all that many projects while he was the state architect. But this was, I think, one of his best works, one of the highest profile projects that he did. Besides the Supreme Court, which it was obviously designed for, it was also designed to house the state law library and actually the state library of Oregon. And those functions had been housed in the Capitol building up until that point. So they moved into the Supreme Court building when it opened in 1914. And it's a good thing because that Capitol building burned to the ground in 1936. So imagine the law library and the state library having lost all of, you know, having lost all of that content, all those volumes, if it had been burned in that fire. So that was fortunate. And that's what brought about the Art Deco style Capitol that we know today in Oregon. And the state library eventually moved out of the building, but the building has, since it opened in 1914, has housed the Supreme Court and the law library.
From the outset, the project team confronted a central question. How can an early 1900s masonry building endure a major Cascadia subduction zone earthquake while retaining its historic integrity?
In addition to being used by the Supreme Court, the building's also used by the State Court of Appeals. And the courts are really, they're really an important institution in our state, right? They need to be able to function regardless of what's happening in the outside world. And actually, maybe better put, they need to be able to function because of what's happening in the outside world, right? So the primary goals of the court were really seismic resilience, energy and water efficient systems, occupant comfort, and through all that, really protecting and continuing to protect and preserve the historic character of the building that that makes it so special.
A building like this and what we have to do and how we have to work together is, if you haven't worked together before, you know, you're going to have a long curve to try to figure out where everybody's coming from. But, you know, there was a great deal of trust between our firms.
This is Jerry Hein, Senior Project Manager at Hoffman Construction.
With a building like this, your budgets, you know, you're putting together as a contractor, they are always going to seem high, because no matter how much money you think you're budgeting for something, it's never going to be enough, because any kind of a renovation, especially a historical renovation, it's a voyage of discovery. And every time you open another wall or go to another part of the building, or, you know, try to figure out how the electrical was run or the plumbing is run, or deal with, you know, wood and marble and all the things, stained glass, all these things that are very old and very integral to the integrity of the building, it costs a lot of money. And I think that working together and trusting each other, and also building the trust of the Oregon Judicial Department, you know, to come along with us on that journey, discover and solve.
Pre-design investigations, including in-place structural and material testing, geotechnical analysis, and digital simulations, guided a careful evaluation of retrofit strategies. Each option was measured against cost, duration, risk to historic fabric, and long-term performance.
For a project of this type specifically, you need to know what you're dealing with. Right. Like, if you don't understand the patient, you can't treat the patient, to put it in sort of the, you know, the medical analogy. So, you know, from some of the historic documentation, we knew generally what the building structure was. We knew generally what was inside of the walls. But in order to design a building to be seismically resilient, we needed to know precisely what was there, because the forces that are involved require specificity, right, in order to design the interventions. So, for example, we knew from the drawings that the structure of the building were built up steel columns. And by built up, I mean they weren't rolled as one piece. They were several pieces of steel that were riveted together. And so we needed to expose some of those so that we could document specifically what was there, how thick of a steel plate made up the flange or made up the web, what types of shapes were there, how many rivets, how far spaced apart, because those things all point towards how it will perform under loading. So it's really important to have that data before you start. Other things we did in a similar vein were brick pull tests to sort of determine how mortar joints between the brick in the unreinforced masonry walls, how much force they would be able to withstand before they started to slide apart. We also did floor cores to understand sort of the thickness and the makeup of the floor assemblies, again, to see how they would react to seismic loading. So those were the primary ones that we did, but it was a prolonged preliminary phase because we really did need to understand the patient.
Step-by-step collaboration and creativity was essential to meet approval codes with strict landmark preservation requirements.
Yeah, I think the key to success on, like, as you mentioned, on projects like this is just to have early conversations. You know, from a building code standpoint, you know, new buildings or applying building codes to new buildings is complex, but it's relatively straightforward, right? You're generating everything that's going to be there. With existing buildings, it gets a little bit more complicated because there are always aspects of those existing buildings that aren't code compliant. And what do you do about those deficiencies, right? With historic buildings, it adds a whole nother wrinkle to it because there are character defining features about that building that can't be heavily modified or removed or, you know, what have you. So, you know, the key to it with this building was some early conversations, with a lot of projects like this, early conversations, and then some creativity early on about, well, we need to address this. We're not going to be able to do it in certain ways because of the historic character. What are some creative solutions to accomplishing what we call an equivalency that sort of still meets the intent of the code? On the historic side, we have a very good relationship with the State Historic Preservation Office and other, you know, historic agencies. So same thing, early discussions. I think to the extent that they can know what the issues are and know what's coming, I think it helps everyone to sort of be prepared for what those trade-offs might be and what those equivalencies might wind up being. I should note too that for the last 7 years, I've sat on the Portland Historic Landmarks Commission. I'm currently the chair of the commission. And so I get to see it from the other side as well. I get to, you know, see projects come in that for land use, you know, zoning approval. And I think the same thing holds true. We have design advice request meetings that where teams can get in front of the commission early on and talk about where they are with the project, what a couple of major alternatives might be, and get feedback on which one of those might be set the project up better for an approval down the road. So all reinforces the same point.
The seismic retrofit integrates a triple friction pendulum base isolation system with traditional shear walls. By decoupling the building from ground motion, the base isolation system allows the structure to remain essentially stationary while the earth oscillates up to 2 feet laterally beneath it.
So the Cascadia subduction zone is out several miles offshore, out underneath the Pacific Ocean, where the Juan de Fuca plate under the ocean actually subducts beneath the North American plate. And that's very different from down in California, the San Andreas Fault, which actually is just an extension of the subduction zone offshore of us. It's on land, and it's a fault line where the plates sort of slide past each other in a horizontal fashion. The subduction zone up here is where a plate's running underneath. And what happens as the plate runs underneath is the plates bind themselves together. And over time, decades, centuries, that those forces build and build and build until eventually something happens to make them break free and they slip. And we don't get a lot of seismic activity here in the Pacific Northwest, but when we do, it's the big one. Or, you know, there are other smaller incidents, but they're not nearly as frequent as they are, say, in California and other places. So what all that means for us as architects is we've got a design basically for an 8 to 9 magnitude earthquake, even though they don't happen but every 300, 400, 500 years. The last documented one was in the year 1700. So that was 326 years ago. So we've entered the sort of the danger zone, I guess, for lack of a better phrase. So when we look at modernizing historic buildings, this is something we have to wrestle with. There makes no sense to reinvest tens of millions of dollars into a historic resource without preparing it for that event. So there are really two different primary types of seismic rehabilitation. And I'm not a structural engineer. I'm like doing my best to play structural engineer when I talk about this stuff. But one is fixed base. And that means that the buildings connect to the ground and you're acknowledging that as the ground starts to shake sideways, the building is going to start to shake. And you're doing things to the superstructure of the building to resist those forces, right? There's a whole separate approach, which is called base isolation. And what that means is that you're essentially decoupling the building from the ground so that when the ground starts shaking violently, the building starts to sort of drift around, but in a very much more sort of dampened kind of way. And the element that allows the building to stand, you know, on its foundation, but also be decoupled from the ground is a base isolator. And in this case, we wound up using a triple friction pendulum isolator, which is just a variety of a base isolator. And without images, it's a little difficult to describe, but essentially it's sort of two inverted cups. And inside of them are another pair of smaller cups and a core element, a hard core. And as the ground begins to move, these cups sort of ride up on each other. But the more they ride towards the edge, the more the gravity, the mass of the building works against that movement because it's trying to lift the building up. So it ever increases the level of friction inside of that base isolator. And so because it's a multi-piece element and it operates on friction that's generated by the movement of it trying to push up and the weight of the building trying to push down, you get the name triple friction pendulum isolator.
It sounds a little bit like the building's log rolling on this thing moving back and forth.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like a piece of mechanical equipment sitting on a damper, right? Like the mechanical equipment's vibrating and this damper sort of decoupling it from the structure so that the structure doesn't also vibrate. I kind of think of it as being somewhat similar to that.
From the design, from the architectural design standpoint, I mean, when you're trying to fit in additional structural members that are actually up through the building, as well as, you know, the base isolators are kind of underneath things, so they're kind of out of view largely, but going up through the building, you have a lot of added steel. And, you know, you know that you're going to have a lot of challenges to maintain the amazing finishes that are in the building and put all that steel in. And I think that was probably one of the biggest things that, you know, we knew that was going to be the case. And it's like, okay, what parts of this building are we actually going to have to tear into in order to do a lot of this work? And oh, by the way, Mr. Designer, you know, you got to help us. You got to help us figure out what the best approach might be and what you can tolerate.
The interior finishes encompassed several historical materials that necessitated preservation and updated matching, including original marble, mahogany wood, ornamental plaster, and a striking stained glass lay light.
The predominant materials within the inside of the building, marble is definitely one of them. There are actually, I believe, three types of marble you know, they're building a new Supreme Court building for the state back in 1912, 1913. They're thinking big, like they're not sparing expense necessarily. So predominantly the floors are Alaska marble. The wall bases are a darker, like verde marble, darker green marble. And then all of the walls and wainscoting through the building is actually marble from Vermont. So just, you know, sourcing these, put it on a train, ship it across the country, you know. There's also quite a bit of mahogany, a lot of the wall paneling in the justice chambers, wood trim work in various places in the building is some really nice mahogany. And then, you know, ornamental plaster mostly at the ceiling level. So as far as rehab, a lot of these materials were preserved in place. Some of them, particularly the wood paneling, had to be demounted, labeled, stored, and then reinstalled. But we removed and reinstalled the vast majority just to minimize the amount of material that we would need to source new. And then really, I think maybe the crowning feature in the interior of the building is at the top of the court chamber is a Povey Brothers ley light. And the Povey Brothers, if you're not familiar, were a renowned stained glass manufacturer, and they actually were based right here in the Willamette Valley. They were referred to by some as the Tiffany of the West, I believe is what they were called. And if you're not familiar with the term ley light, it's essentially a skylight, but it's not a skylight that is exposed to the elements, because a stained glass laid in horizontally or in a shallow vault can't really be exposed to the weather. So there is actually a clear skylight at the roof level above the Supreme Court chamber, and then an attic space. And then at the ceiling level of the Supreme Court chamber is this, what we refer to as a ley light. So that light shines through the skylight, through the attic space, and it actually still illuminates the ceiling. So it's a really important, notable architectural feature of the building. And for anybody who's seen the Supreme Court room, it's a very dominant feature as well.
You're trying to save some money. You're trying not to just make this be an exorbitantly expensive project. And so like one of the things, so the project had a lot of wood and you know, it had a lot of marble and you're trying to match and salvage. And, you know, you're not always able to match very well because the patina and whatever, and you know, where stone was quarried or even like the wood, you know, the grain of the wood and the stain of the wood. And so you've got a lot of challenges in terms of trying to match things, and you kind of convince yourselves that, oh yeah, we can do it. And plus the other thing is that, because it was a historic building, believe it or not, you know, like the judges and that, they actually wanted sort of some of the patina of an old building. And so, I mean, they were like going, hey, it's okay if some of that wood is, you know, still kind of marred up and like in the corridors, you know, I mean, that wood just gets nicked up over time, right? And so everybody up front is saying, yeah, we don't need to replace all of that. You know, we like some of that character of the scarring of the wood and the maybe the scratches in the marble. And then you start in and you start making the building beautiful again. And in places you actually have to put in new wood or you have to put in new marble. And, you know, people start looking at that and they go, oh, wow, that really looks nice. And so then the challenge becomes, okay, now you said that you liked the patina of this old marred up stuff, but yeah, side by side, you know, you're going, maybe, you know, maybe not so much. So then it becomes a matter of, okay, how do we solve this and still not make it, you know, not have it be a complete replacement, because you don't want to do that. And you don't want to spend a ridiculous amount of money trying to figure out how to refinish some of this stuff. And so I would say that was probably one of the biggest challenges. You know, you anticipate or you make a plan for how much you're going to replace and how much you're going to restore. And then as things, and I really do mean this, as things become restored and things are really, really, it's like, wow, this is really beautiful. This is amazing. And then you see this stuff next to it that's not so beautiful because you've chosen not to do it. And so that there was a lot of hand wringing over how are we going to deal with that.
The marble restoration required particular attention in matching old with new.
The marble, as often is the case with projects of this age, the stone, the quarry that the stone came from is no longer active. Like that's a very common challenge. And in the case of the Supreme Court, we had to go and, because we did need replacement marble, particularly in the restrooms, which were clad with marble, just like the stairway and public lobbies. We did need supplemental marble, and we went through a lot of iterations of trying to find marble and getting samples in and laying them out there in the field and looking at them and to figure out which one or ones would be the best replacement. You know, if you can't match it, you at least try and get as close as you can. The type of marble that is in the Supreme Court building is pretty heavily veined marble, and it's variable. So we couldn't just pick one marble type to patch in. We had to get a variety of them and determine for a certain location in the building which marble would actually be the best match for that and which marble would be the best match over here. So it was a bit of a painstaking process, but that's what's required when you can't go to the source anymore. Fortunately, the lay light did not have to come out. It was retained in place. But I like to joke that so the top of it is in the attic space. It had such an accumulation of dust across the entire top of it that literally simply was just carefully vacuumed off, essentially. I like to joke that, you know, we should have gotten a lead point just for like the amount of increased light that was coming through that after we got all the grime and dust cleared off of it.
In close collaboration with Hoffman Construction, the union, and the plaster subcontractor, the project helped revive the fading craft of ornamental plasterwork by establishing an apprentice program dedicated to the careful removal, restoration, and replacement of the building's historic plaster.
The project required a fair amount of removal of plaster ornamentation. It also required some casting of new plaster ornamentation. So we followed a pretty typical process of creating molds of existing plaster elements, like a bracket, say, at the edge of the ceiling and wall connection. And then those new pieces were cast into those molds and then reinstalled in the building. There's a challenge in the preservation world that the skilled artisans and skilled tradespeople who work with historic features like, you know, terracotta and plaster and, you know, to some degrees, you know, carved stone, their numbers are dwindling, and they have been for decades. And so at the beginning of this project, the Plasterers Union in this area is Plasterers Local 82. And at the beginning of the project, I forget the numbers, there were 60 some skilled plasterers in the entire state of Oregon. And there were many that were needed for this project because of the amount of plaster work that happened. So this really great thing happened where our contractor, Hoffman Construction, partnered with the union and the plaster sub, and they basically used the project as an apprenticeship program to train and increase the number of skilled plasterers in the state. And I think a really great success story for the project is that the number of skilled plasterers in the state almost doubled over the course of the of this apprenticeship program and the project. And I think that really bodes well for preservation moving forward, because if these trades are allowed to, these artisans are allowed to disappear, you know, the skills are allowed to disappear, then we're really in a bad spot when it comes to preserving this architectural heritage that we have.
The rehabilitation achieves a 59% PEUI reduction from the AIA 2030 baseline and has earned LEED Gold certification, making the building one of only two historic base isolated structures in the nation to reach this standard, and the very first in Oregon.
The biggest thing really is that we retained the building and didn't demolish it and replace it with a new Supreme Court building, right? Like, so like starting at the top of that sort of pyramid, when you retain the vast majority of the structure and enclosure and interior components of a building, you're really retaining all of that embodied carbon. And rather than, you know, going it to the, taking it to the landfill and expending all that much more carbon in the mining, manufacture, delivery, and assembly of a new building. So that's really the big thing. Other factors, you know, we installed energy efficient HVAC systems, low flow plumbing fixtures, all of the lighting in the building was retrofit with LED lamps. And some of those drop ceilings that I mentioned before that happened from later construction, a lot of those were removed and ceilings were sort of raised back to closer to their historic heights so that much more natural daylighting comes in. So even though you have efficient LED lighting, sometimes you don't necessarily even need to have it on because we've increased the amount of natural daylight. So the new heating and cooling systems achieve nearly a 25% reduction in energy use, a 35% reduction in water usage. And overall, there's a metric called the PEUI, the predicted energy use intensity, which just tries to aggregate all of sort of like the per square foot reduction in energy usage. So we had an EUI of about 59% energy use reduction as compared to the AIA 2030 baseline building. So a significant reduction. It's not a net zero building, but, you know, I think for what it is, I think we achieve some meaningful energy and water reduction as part of it.
In my opinion, 59% on a historic building is incredible.
Yeah, if we had had a program and a place to put PV, say, we could have actually gotten the building to much, much closer to being net zero than we did.
The enormity of retrofitting the historic building with protection from a potential cataclysmic seismic event presented the biggest design challenge.
The design challenge of the project was how to protect the building from a future seismic event without destroying the building or the things that make the building special in the process. And that's where I think the conversation about this election to go to a base isolated system really comes into play. And in this building, a fixed base solution would have meant some pretty massive shear walls to get constructed up through the building to the roof. And there aren't great places to do that because most of the spaces are, you know, primary importance. One of the things we do at the outset of a project is to map out what we call the integrity zones. So, you know, there's three. Zone one is preservation. Like those are the most important historic spaces that have had the least amount of intervention into them. Sorry, zone one is restoration. Zone two is rehabilitation, which means maybe these aren't the most primary historic spaces, or maybe they are important spaces, but they've had some alterations done to them that maybe aren't reversible. And then zone three, which is we call renovation, which are the, you know, sort of these behind, you know, off the corridor, whatever. It's either it's never been an important historic space, or it's been so changed that there's no really hope for it. So there's a lot of zone one and zone two spaces in this building. And a lot of that is because of the finishes that we talked about before. So to have removed enough of these finishes to make way for these massive shear walls, and then just the size of the shear walls themselves would have meant removing the vast majority of the historic fabric from inside this building. So then you're preserving the building for what? You're sort of you're reconstructing the inside of it, right? So that's where the base isolation really was fantastic, because it limited the forces that the building will experience in the earthquake by so much that we just had to do some much more limited sort of lateral bracing, some shear walls at the near the corners, which we were able to deal with, but nothing on the scale that would have been the case. So that upfront pre-design time that we talked about was really spent understanding the building, mapping out alternatives, and then convincing ourselves that the best thing for the building was to jump in with both feet and do this base isolation.
During construction, a temporary new support system needed precise implementation before the base isolators could be installed.
In construction, like, just to ground us in like what it meant to do this structural project, you have to essentially build temporary foundation supports outside of the footprint of the existing columns that all came down into the base through the basement and into the foundation. To basically build a new support for the building that's going to hold it for months. Then you have to demolish the basement columns, all the foundations, and then install what I think was in the order of about a 4-foot thick mat foundation. So it's this heavily reinforced 4-foot thick concrete pad that extended the entire footprint of the building. And then set these base isolators in place that support the ground floor, and then remove all the temporary supports that have been holding the building for the last, I don't know, year or plus. And the thing that I think amazed me the most about it was, I believe that the tolerance for movement with transferring the loads of the building to the temporary supports and then transferring the load of the building back onto the new base isolators was 1/8 of an inch. So that was a challenge. I mean, that is the challenge. Like I don't know. And I think it was a known challenge, but just to have been a witness to what sort of infrastructure, what sort of planning that it took to achieve that. Because if it moves more than 1/8 of an inch, you know, if it moves differentially, then things rack inside, you know, up above and, you know, things start to pop off the wall or get crushed. So it had to just remain as level and square as it possibly could, all the while there was this massive, you know, new foundation project going on underneath it. So I've got lots of stories about like things we discovered in historic buildings that are really fun and interesting, but like I think the headline here is this building was basically the foundation was demolished out from under it and a new one built. And the building basically had to remain exactly where it was.
For Andrew, comprehending the scope of this historical preservation and seismic retrofit project mandated a bold mindset.
It was a really good lesson for me in thinking big. Because, you know, a lot of times with historic preservation work, you're trying to do these light touches, right? You're trying to fix a thing by doing this really simple little intervention. And I think zooming out, it seemed a little bit crazy at the time to contemplate doing a base isolation for this particular building. But I guess the lesson is sort of don't rule out options that's just because they seem unrealistic from the jump. Like really study it and try and be bold, right? If we hadn't gone there, if we hadn't been in that headspace, we may not have wound up with the same result that we did. But I think it was absolutely the right solution for this particular building, even though it seemed audacious at the time. So think big.
The Oregon Supreme Court building's modernization is not an overlay of new systems onto old walls. It is a recalibration of structure, performance, and civic symbolism. By inserting resilience below grade and sustainability within the envelope, the project preserves the building's Beaux Arts composure while equipping it for an uncertain seismic future. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what best practices Andrew would advise in approach and planning to ensure success on a high-profile building like this project.
I think it starts with building a talented team of people across all your disciplines and building a team that has historic experience. I don't think there's a lot of good substitutes for having done historic work and just having the sensitivity to know what's what and what might be a good idea and what probably is going to be a bad idea for the building. As I talked about before, invest in the upfront planning and investigation. It will pay dividends down the road for sure. We didn't come up with the integrity zones mapping that I talked about, zones 1 through 3, but we use it a lot. And I would encourage others who are doing historic projects to take the time to create a color-coded floor plans of each floor of the building and the exterior elevations and determine amongst the team and the client, what are the most important spaces? What are the spaces where you've got some flexibility? And what are the spaces where you really can do that heavy lift of new program and reconfiguration where you need to? Those early discussions with the building officials and state historic preservation offices and whoever else has the agency in the project. And then pick the right contractor. And again, contractor that has done historic work, because it's tough to fake it till you make it with historic projects. You got to have somebody that's got a level of sophistication and knows how to treat these really important places and buildings.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Andrew, and I learned a lot. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
Our built environment, I think, is one of the best ways that we convey our cultural heritage, our past. And they're one of the most visible ways, right? Like, art does that. There's other media that do that. But I think everybody who moves around in a city or a town is constantly passing buildings. And I think those buildings, they represent so much, each one of them. And so I think a lot of architects get fulfillment out of creating the new thing. And I get that. And I get some fulfillment out of doing that. But for me, it's if my work can breathe new life into a historic resource, you know, give it a new use that will keep it viable for another couple of generations, or seismically retrofit it so that it actually still is standing, to be able to be that link to the past and to be able to tell the stories, or at least be the genesis of the stories that it has to tell. Like, I think for me, that's what got me hooked, you know, way back in my Chicago days with the Burnham Plan. And I think it's really what's propelled me professionally, is knowing that there's a lot more buildings that are consequential to someone. Doesn't matter who, there's to someone or some group that will live on much, much longer as a result of the work that I've done. So that's what keeps me getting up every morning and putting on my historical architect hat.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, ARCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try ARCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit ARCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.